Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello and welcome to this episode number 87 of the Free Cities Podcast. I hope you are well on this fine summer's day. Well, it's sunny for me here at least. I hope you've had a great week. I'm feeling incredibly excited today. We're off on our family holiday tomorrow morning, up early with the kids on a long road trip to our family's favourite secret surfing spot. Can't tell you where that is, unfortunately, or I'd have to kill you, but I can't wait for that. In the meantime, of course, there's no rest for the wicked. It's podcast day. And today I've got a good one for you. I'm having a conversation with Germany's most successful non-fiction author. Mark Friedrich has written 7 best-selling books, the latest of which is called The Greatest Revolution of All Time. And that book's about preserving your wealth through what Mark says is the inevitable coming failure of the current monetary system. Now, this subject forms the meat and bones of what we're talking about during this discussion, but we also talk about a few other things, including Mark's opinion on gold in the light of Bitcoin being discovered. Mark's a gold bug. His horrific experiences of hyperinflation whilst living in Argentina, some phenomenal stories there, and his general guide to prepping for the future and how to escape the proverbial matrix of modern life. If you don't know what prepping is, look it up. It's derived from the word prepare. Anyway, many thanks to Mark for taking the time to come and speak to me. And if you want to hear more from him, he has a very well-subscribed German-speaking YouTube channel, so you need to be a German speaker. And over there, you can join the other 500,000 people who follow his content. If not, get on over to his website to pick up one of his books, or failing that, of course, you're on my channel here. There's always one option available to you. Now I have your undivided attention, and that is to, of course, just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Mark Friedrich. All right, I've started already, but
okay.
Might actually ask you then, since we're on the subject of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. When did you sort of fall into the rabbit hole?
I discovered Bitcoin in 2000. The first time actually was in 2011. A customer, because I'm a financial consultant, asked me if I would yet recommend to invest some money in Bitcoin. And I asked him, what's that? I never heard about it. And he told me, yeah, it's this funny magic internet money. And I said, hey, it's definitely a scam. So, but I didn't dive into it. I just warned him and said, it's a scam. Don't invest any money. You can throw it out of the window. So, oh, you give it to me. So that was the first time. And then the second time my path crossed with Bitcoin was for my second book I wrote. I did research for a sound monetary system. And I'm still a big gold bug. And I studied the past and the monetary system of the last 2000 years. And then during my research on the internet, I crossed this Bitcoin thing again. I thought, oh, it's still around. That's interesting. So I printed out the white paper from Satoshi Nakamoto, and I was really surprised that it's still around, because I thought it's a scam, and all scams, like, how long do they last? Like 1 year. So I printed it out and I put it on my night desk, but I had no time to read it. It looked boring and it wasn't English, and I was busy at this time for my second book. So, and then I remember I went to Würzburg, it's a German city, and I was doing a presentation for my first book, and there were like 1,000 people, and it was a great night, and I came home, I was full of adrenaline, and I went to bed and I couldn't fall asleep. So, and my night desk was empty, there was just this boring white paper from Satoshi Nakamoto, and I thought, okay, come on, give it a chance. Read it. And I thought, hey, it's so boring, I will fall asleep in a second. But the opposite happened, actually. I was quite awake and I couldn't sleep. I was like really on fire, actually. I woke up my wife and I told her, hey, this is it. This is the best monetary system. This was the thing I was looking for. And she was like, what the fuck? Leave me alone or I get a divorce. And I was so on fire. I couldn't sleep this night. And the first thing I did the next day was I tried to buy Bitcoin in Germany in 2013. It wasn't that easy. It took me like 2 or 3 days till I discovered a way to purchase Bitcoin, and that's how it started, actually. And I still get goosebumps when I talk about it, because it was such a magic experience. I realized this is something special. This is like a present from heaven. I was looking for my whole life, because in 2001 I experienced the government crisis in Argentina. I was there in Buenos Aires when everything collapsed. I lost money. I saw how chaos and anarchy actually was on the streets. I got robbed from my guard. I got robbed from the taxi driver on the way to the airport when I tried to escape, and everything. You know, I just saw how the peso just lost all his purchasing power in 4 hours. You know, at eight o'clock in the morning, I went to my shop. I was working there for a German company. And I wondered, why is nobody here? What happened? Why are all these queues in front of the banks? And then like 1 or 2 hours later, a colleague called me and he said, hey, didn't you hear? We're bankrupt. It's the state, the government failed, and the peso is nearly worthless. And I went to the next supermarket and I used all my pesos, and it was only the half I could purchase, actually. So it was 50% already devalued. And then 1 or 2 hours later, nobody accepted pesos anymore, just like dollar or gold or your watch or something, you know, like that. Yeah. So, and that was the time when I realized, okay, I have to dive into monetary systems, because in the end of the 90s I was also speculating on the stock market with the Nasdaq and the dot-com bubble, and I made money, but I still wondered, how could this happen, like this bubbles and everything. And then 2 years later, 1 year later, I experienced a crisis in Argentina, and then I thought, okay, I have to dive into it. So I went back home after, like, I got robbed from the taxi driver on the way to the airport, and I had to get a new passport from the German embassy. It was quite interesting, but I was happy to get out of this mess. And then I was reading like for 2 years. The first thing I did, actually, I bought gold. Back then, I went to my German little bank and I asked them to buy gold, and they were like looking at me, and the guy, the clerk, said, okay, this is the stupidest this decision you've ever made. And back then, I think it was an all-time low in gold. It was like I don't know, 1 ounce was like 200, no, even less, 150 euros. And I bought a whole kilogram, and he told me, this is stupid and you will
physical
regret it.
Physical gold?
Pardon me?
As physical gold.
As physical gold.
1 kilogram of physical gold.
I bought, it was everything I had, actually. I sold all my stocks and I got all my money from the accounts, and I just bought 1 kilogram of gold, and it was, I don't know how much it was like 15 or 20,000 euros. And he told me, you will regret it one day. It's a stupid decision. Nobody wants this fucking rock. I was like, no, I want to do it. And then I dived into it. I was reading every book I could find about currency resets, about hyperinflation, about failed states and empires who faltered and everything. And I was so intrigued by how it happened every time again. Like this, it's like a cycle. It's like the sun goes up and the sun goes down. It's like day and night. So, and I thought, why is the humanity so stupid all the time? There is one empire rising, and then there is a crazy cracker up on in the front of the government, and they devalue the currencies, inflation will happen, then they start with socialism, you know, like bread and circuses in the Roman Empire, but all the time. And then they always start with a sound monetary system, and then after time, when they try to get elected or when they start wars, they have to inflate the monetary system, and then all starts to falter and all starts to crumble, and then it's the end. And then at the end, you have socialism, you have revolutions, you have wars. It's always the fucking same game. And I just realized it. And then after that, I just started allocate my money in different assets, actually, so in sound money, like in gold. And I started to consult people about financial decisions, and at first family and friends, and afterwards I started my own business because more and more people came. And in 2006, I used to live in the US, in Boston and in Vermont, and I just had a friend, he came from the university, and he told me, Mark, hey, listen, I get married, I'm from the university, I just graduated, and I want to offer my wife something, and so I go to the bank, I want to get a loan for a house. And I was laughing at him because I'm a German, you know, and in Germany, you have to work and you need money on the bank account, so you get a loan and so on. And I said, okay, I want to see that. I want to laugh about you. So we went to a bank in Burlington, Vermont, and after 5 minutes, he received a check over $350,000 to buy a house, and he had nothing. And I was like, okay, this is a scam, this is a bubble, this will explode. So I went home like 1 week later and I told everybody in Germany. I organized events where I hold presentations and told him, this is the biggest speculation bubble in history. This will go down. But this was in 2006, Tim. So I was 2 years too early. And I remember my father was sitting in the first row because I forced him to come, and he was just shaking his head and he said, hey, listen, you're out of my last will. You're crazy. Yeah. And 2 years later, when everything went down, people remembered me and said, hey, there was this crazy Swabian economist. So we should call him and ask him for advice. And then everything went up. I started my business. I published my first book. It was a best-selling book. I sold over 300,000 copies, and there was an English translation, a Chinese translation. That's how it happened, actually. And then to finally answer your question, I was searching for a monetary system which wouldn't implode every 80 to 100 years. And gold standard was okay, but not perfect, because it's always in combination with the government. And then I found Bitcoin, and Bitcoin separates for the first time in history the government and the monetary system. And it was just like a present from heaven. I was like, okay, I'm enlightened, and I have to tell the world. And that's how it happened. This was in 2013. And since then, I'm a very, very vocal advocate of Bitcoin. I know it's the solution. I think it's even more than just a monetary system. For me, it's spiritual. And I think it's so important for the human race in the next couple of centuries. And I think it's a present from heaven, actually. So once I had an interview with Max Kaiser and Stacey, and I asked them if perhaps Satoshi Nakamoto was like Jesus 2.0. And so I think it's a present, and we are blessed that we live in times like those. So what a time to be alive, actually.
Funnily enough, we've spoken on this podcast about the similarity between the second coming of Christ and not Satoshi Nakamoto, but actually Bitcoin itself. Because I would posit that if you think about the second coming, which was supposed to happen around the year 2000, right? There's a lot of religions say something big will happen around the year 2000, including the second coming of Christ, and it happened in 2009. But I don't think it would be a person. I think that's what you would expect it to be. It would be a second coming of sorts, and in fact, it might well have been Bitcoin itself, which was the thing, because there's no way that someone, say, the second coming of Jesus would happen the way you expected it. It would always happen in a strange way. And it is something we've talked about in the past, actually.
Yeah. But who would be that, I don't know if it's the right English word, but who would be that altruistic? Altruistic? Or
yeah,
like Satoshi Nakamoto, because right now, if he's still around, if he's alive, and it's a present for humanity, he would be one of the richest person in the world. He would be on every cover of every magazine. Everybody would invite him. I think even David Letterman would come back and ask him for an interview. So he would be one of the most famous persons in the world, and he's still not coming out, and he's not touching his deck. So I think it's definitely a present, like in the past. I think there were many presents in the past from, I don't know, like aliens or gods for the human race, and I think this is one, because it came to the for the right time. It's actually born in a crisis, you know. Bitcoin is a child of the financial crisis. That's when Satoshi Nakamoto just said, okay, we need a better monetary system. The last 2,000 years years, and it every time it collapses, it every time creates like poverty and inflation and revolutions and civil wars or wars even. So we need a better solution. And this is the solution, actually. We have to separate the government and the money. And this is what Bitcoin actually delivers for us. And it's a golden opportunity. It's an orange opportunity for orange future.
It's funny, as far as how can Satoshi Nakamoto be so superhuman about, you know, not spending his Bitcoin? I think Occam's razor would say that he's either dead or I think I veer on the side of alien. And I know that sounds absolutely out of this world.
No.
But it does make sense to me. The only thing that I think might actually go against that is the fact that there were bugs in the code originally that needed to be fixed. And you would imagine if this was something from a very supreme, you know, intelligence. Yeah,
nobody's perfect. Even Aileen has a bad day.
I don't know about that. Anyway, no, but
I'm with you, actually. I wrote a whole chapter in my new book. And because the most frequent question actually I receive is, who is Satoshi Nakamoto? And I went down this rabbit hole and I talked to many people and people also who worked with him together. And I think it's definitely, he's not human. And perhaps it sounds like crazy, but I think we are ready because Bitcoin came for the right time. And we all feel this transformation. We all feel that there's a paradigm shift going on. This is a turning point in history because I think COVID was one of those. I think the financial crisis was one of the of those turning points. And I think we all feel that something changed in the whole system all over the world. We see we will never go back in the era before COVID. Everything changed with COVID, I think. And we feel that something is going on in the whole system with humanity. And I think the next couple of years will be really volatile, really challenging. But also after this catharsis, I think we will have a golden future as humanity because we need to get to another level, actually. And we need this crisis, the next crisis, all the crisis to make progress. If you look in your own biography, when did you learn the most? In a crisis, I guess. I think when I look at you, the first bad grades in school or the first betrayal with friends or your girlfriend or something like that, this is what makes us stronger and better. Because crises are, you have to embrace every crisis in your life because you learn out of it. Because if you always like have the golden spoon up your ass, yeah, you learn nothing. Yes, look at the rich blokes from, I don't know, Oxford or something. They don't learn anything. But you have to make experiences, bad experiences. You have to make bad choices and you have to be young and wild and do the wrong stuff, drink too much and so on to realize what's the right path. And that's where we are right now. And I think more and more people wake up and realize, okay, this is changing. Something is happening in this world. This is the paradigm shift I was writing about. And all the cycles come all over again. And we're actually privileged that we are living right now and can perhaps like form the future of humanity.
I take it you are a fan of the book The Fourth Turning?
Yes, very much. Oh, okay. I had an interview with Neil Howe 1 year ago, and Fourth Turning was also a change in my life, definitely a game changer in my perspective on the world. And it's I love cycles because cycles, it's like math. We know there are cycles out there, and they actually, nobody can say, oh, they don't work for me or something like that. But hey, there is like the tides, and there is day and night, and there is young and old, and there is life and death, and everybody is influenced by cycles. So the fourth turning, the generational cycle, which I also describe in my new book, actually, is there, and it's happening right now, and we are at winter, and it's like Game of Thrones. Winter is not coming. We are already in winter, and winter is actually at first bad, but afterwards it will be much better.
Okay, then. So I've seen you talk about this before, actually, that we are at this inflection point. And you could refer back to the fourth turning here, but how large is the cycle of the inflection point that we're at now, according to you? Because the fourth turning talks about 1,000-year cycles. Yeah. Large cycles. I read it a long time ago.
Okay, I know there are many more cycles, actually, and I tried to put the most important cycles in my work and in my last book. And there is also a monetary cycle, there's a politics cycle, there is a war cycle. And I think these cycles are all combined, are coming together right now, and they escalate. And this is the biggest fourth turning for humanity, I think, because we've never been more people on this planet. We've been never more more progress. We have AI, we have technology, the globalization brought us all together. So like 100 years ago, if something happened in Japan, nobody cared. And if you realized it like 1 year later, but right now you have it in real time over X, or Twitter, or on the news. So it's different time. So it's actually escalating. And right now I think it's the biggest fourth turning and the biggest change, game changer for the human race. And it will be mind blowing. We can't imagine it. We will be on a new level of, what is it called? I think, for all our mind, it's a new experience we never had. I think we all have like the possibility to use our brain for 5%, 10%. But after this, I think we will use more than 50%, and we all will wake up in a new world, actually.
That's interesting. How do you imagine that manifests? You're talking about a renaissance of consciousness, aren't you, really?
Exactly.
Yeah, but how does that actually manifest? Are you talking about, how do you suddenly get something? I know you're obviously very animated by Bitcoin, and I agree. I'm the same. It has changed me on many levels, and it began with even the thought, thinking about it, analyzing it, and it began sort of like taking a part of many of the concepts that I thought I understood.
Everything.
Yeah.
Only money, yeah. Politics, society, behavior of human race. It's like, yeah, exit the matrix. You know, if you exit the matrix once, you never can go back. And if you see once, you never can be unseen, everything. So it changes everything. I lost so much faith, actually, in the old world. And I think this is just a scam. The old world is a scam. Everything. I laugh about it. It's a clown world, actually. No, in Germany, for example, when I graduated high school, I had biology as a main subject. And I learned that there are like two sexes, and that's it. Yeah. Now we talk about 46 different sexes and genders and everything. So I just laugh about it. I think it's okay. This is a hubris, and this is decadence. And if you look in the past of human history, always when an empire falters get destroyed, it's decadency all over the place. You can see it in the Roman Empire. You can see it in the Greek Empire. It's everywhere, and right now we see it in front of us. So you're absolutely right. If you dive down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, it's not only about money and economy and finance and investment and get rich quick. No, it's about much more. I think I passed this level already, like a couple of years ago. Now it's about creating the future, and I think Bitcoin is just like the key to open the door for a whole new world on every level. We can't imagine it right now. I think we're still too simple-minded to realize what a golden orange future will be behind this door. And we have to be brave to go there. And I think many people will just jump from the balcony because they can't. They will realize they were living a lie, a fucking lie. Everything was a lie. Everything will crumble. And yeah, you're laughing, but I think it will be a really hard time for this cleaning process. And I think most people will just, I don't know, get crazy.
I'm laughing because I'm excited, I'll be honest.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait, actually. But but Tim, don't laugh, because I think it will be horrible. It will be horrible. We're looking forward to, we both can't wait. We think, hopefully it happens tomorrow morning at 5:00. But when it happens, we will both cry.
You're absolutely right. But there is one of the advantages of predicting something like this is you can prepare as better as you can for it. One thing that just occurred to me, actually, have you spoken to Gigi on your podcast?
Who's that?
You don't know Gigi?
Gigi, of course. No, not yet, yeah.
Because, no, he speaks. I've spoken to him. I had a four-hour conversation with him once.
Marvelous.
And his experience first going down the rabbit hole is amazing, and you should talk to him about it.
I will.
His whole world collapsed literally in the over a period of 24 hours, and it's quite astonishing because he had a spiritual awakening at that time too, and you can sense something similar with you. Yeah,
exactly. But I was actually privileged because I fell into the rabbit hole in 2001, and actually, to be honest, Tim, and I never told anybody about that. It's the first time I realized, when I was a child, my mother prayed with me every night. And when she left, I prayed for my own. I was 5 or 6 years old, and I prayed to create a better world, that somebody or a higher power gives me the power to create a better world. Because I knew as a child that this world is not human. How could this happen? I wasn't working, but I just realized my father comes home and he's tired and he sleeps, and the whole weekend he sleeps. He's just running in the wheel the whole time and has no time for his kids. And I just knew this is not for humans. This is not normal that we work, and then we just die. That's it. So I knew like somebody told me this is not right. So I was praying every night to be a part of a better world and create a better world, which is more human and where we live together, not against each other. So why was I thinking about it? Why was I praying for that? This is crazy. So it was inside of me my whole life. And then it came back with, I was always like a punk, like an outsider. I was always fighting the system and criticizing the system and putting my finger where it really hurts. And I got a lot of shitstorms and everything. It wasn't easy, but now I know it was worth it. And it prepared me for what happened. And then I had this experience in Argentina and at the stock market end of the 90s. So, and now I'm here. So it was actually not happening like in 24 hours, like with Chichi. It happened over years. So I got prepared. And you're definitely right. I think it's our duty to reach out to the people and to reach as many people as possible so they get prepared. Because if they're not prepared, it will be totally chaotic.
Going back to Buenos Aires again, I'm fascinated by that. Actually, I've spoken to people about Argentina, but not anyone that was really there in the heat of it. Like you were talking about noticing, if you look around yourself now, noticing what's going on, what's happening. Were there any signs and signals in Argentina?
Tim, to be honest, I was too young. I was naive. I was too busy playing with girls and enjoying my time in Buenos Aires. And I always, 12 hours before everything collapsed, I was at the Rio de la Plata in a club celebrating with friends, having a good time with beautiful girls and friends and talking about everything. And if you would have told me back then, listen, Mark, in 12 hours, all banks are closed, the peso is worthless and the government collapsed, I would bet all my money I would have against it. I swear to you. I would say never, ever. You're a crazy cracker. You're stupid. No, I bet all my money against it. And then it happened. And this changed everything. It was mind-boggling, actually. It was like, what the heck? It was like a nightmare, like a movie. Yeah, I couldn't believe it because every store closed. People were on the streets. And then I always tell the story. I was living in a guarded community. And the guy who was the warden of this guided community, I talked to him like nearly every day. We were drinking mate tea every day. I was playing with his daughter. And the first night, everything went down the drain. He came into my house at night and he just told me with the pistol on my head, give me the fucking money.
Really?
Yes. And wow. I was shocked. I was like, hey, no way. This is not going to happen. Wow. I thought we're friends. No, he just was like in the honeypot. He knew all the expats and all the foreigners, and he just went from door to door, collect all the money, and I gave him everything I had. I was not that rich, of course, but still, it was a lot of money for him, you know?
That's incredible.
Yeah, and then on the next days, I tried to escape to the country from the country, so I bought a plane ticket, and I went to tried to get to the airport. And the taxi driver, of course, knew all the foreigners leaving the country. And they have everything they own with them. So he didn't go to the airport. He just went left. And then he said, so we can do it either this way or this way. And I said, hey, no, let's fight. Crazy. Problem was, he was like double the size of me and double weight. So he took everything I had. I had bruises all over my face. And I had to walk back to the city. That was like 17 kilometers without shoes, bare feet. Yes, he took everything. That's... my passport, everything. So I went to the embassy, the German embassy, and they gave me money. They gave me clothes. They nourished me, actually. And then 1 week later, I could leave the country.
That's an incredible story.
Life is the best storyteller.
I know, yeah. But that really is an amazing. Yeah.
Story. But you see, it's the psychology of people. Don't get me wrong. I think crises bring the best out of people, but also the worst. And I had great experience in Buenos Aires during this time. People who had nothing gave me everything, you know. For example, there was one farmer. He came to the city and he sold bread to the people against like silver or a watch or something else. And I was sitting there and I talked to him. And he just said, okay, listen, I feel pity for you. Here, take this bread. And he was poorer than I was. And he just gave it to me. You know, people help you in crisis. Humanity grows together in crisis. So if there's something happening, for example, we're in Praha right now, yeah, in Prague. If, for example, a stroller with a baby is moving forward to the street, 99% of people around there would help, would stop the stroller and would rescue the baby, of course. And this is just great. This is what brings us together all over the world, that we have empathy, that we feel love, and that we take care about each other. So there are bad people, of course, and somebody tries to get a chance out of a crisis and robs a foreigner or something. But I know, I believe in karma, and the taxi driver as well as the guard, they did something wrong, and they were not happy with the money they robbed from me. I know that.
When you look back in hindsight at that time, can you, with the benefit of hindsight, see the build up to the crash? I know you said you couldn't see it at the time.
I couldn't see anything. So there was one colleague in my company, Alejandro Speed, actually, and he was a great guy, and he warned me every time. He said, Mark, buy gold. Don't put your money on the bank account. Exchange your money, exchange the peso to the dollar. And I saw, of course, that the prices went up in peso, but I earned my money in dollars, so I couldn't care less. I was like having the time of my life, you know? My money, my purchasing power just went up all the time. And he just warned me all the months, and I didn't believe him. I was like, hey, come on, you're a conspiracy theorist, and they will save the system, of course, and they will just print more money, or they will find a solution. So I was believing into the system. But looking back, I was too naive, I was too busy. So I was actually too superficial to see it. If I would have sit down and read the papers, read the data, I would have seen it in the hindsight. But back then, no, I was too superficial, I was too young, I was too naive, I was too stupid, actually. But he warned me, and he was right. And he put all his money in gold, for example, and he never worked again afterwards, because gold went parabolic in Argentina. He was a made man, he was self-made after that. He quitted his job, and I'm still in contact with him, actually. He's a multi-millionaire in right now. And he made the right decision. And the funny thing is, but one thing he made, he was wrong, because he had a foreign exchange account on the bank in dollar. But the government was clever enough, the new Argentina government was clever enough, and they just created a law that all dollar accounts had to exchange into peso accounts, and then devalued about 73% the whole amount of money on this account. So he got fucked there as well. But the gold, they never touched the gold. It was a brilliant idea. So that's why I became actually a gold bug, and went home and bought this 1 kilogram of gold with all the money I had.
And you're still a gold bug now, is it?
I still think gold is important. It's, you know, we have no gold standard since 1971. But still, all the central banks own gold. And right now, in the last year, and I wrote it in my book, last year, central banks all over the world bought more gold than ever in the last 60 years. So either they don't trust their own monetary system, their own business plan, or they know something else, know that there's another inflation wave coming. They know that fiat monetary systems always collapse and you can't trust the governments. So that's why they own gold. And I think gold is great. Bitcoin is, of course, much better.
So, you're using it as a hedge, would you say? I guess, it sounds like you're a bit of a Bitcoiner.
I'm a Bitcoiner from my heart, but I think I'm not into Bitcoin for getting rich or being superior. I'm in Bitcoin for the change, for the philosophy, and I think it's important. But I've got gold. It's something, it's emotional. You can touch it. And if you have an old Roman golden coin, it's like 2,000 years of history. If you think what this coin just saw in the last 2,000 years, and it's still around and it's still something worth. So I love gold. I think gold is the small brother of Bitcoin. And that's why I want to have it. I want to use it. If there's a blackout or something, I still can exchange my gold, for example. So I know many Bitcoiners don't like that, but I like to diversify my assets, and gold is one of them. And without gold, there wouldn't be Bitcoin, because Satoshi Nakamoto, he realized that gold is also sound money. It is sound, and it's around for 2,000 or 5,000 years actually, and it has a use case.
If we end up on a Bitcoin standard, where do you see gold's role in the world then?
Nowhere.
Nothing.
It's worthless.
Devalued down
it's
to wor- its.
It's worth. It's right. for jewelries and perhaps as a remembrance to the old times. But if people realize that Bitcoin is the scariest asset we ever created, then gold will be worthless.
So okay, we're at an inflection point. You obviously think that a crash is coming of sorts. I've got a couple of questions. One is, obviously, do you have a time scale on that prediction?
Oh, and number
two, yeah, right, I'm sure it is. But number two, and this might help us come to that answer, what are the main characteristics of the times we live in that show you we're heading for a crash?
Decadency, hubris, socialism, and the monetary system, of course. This is the best indicator. If you see wide swings of interest rates going up, going down, going up, we had the lowest interest rates for 10 years in the economic system ever. Yeah. When you see how much debts we have, that is also a very nice indicator to see that we are living at the end times and that the end game is around us. Actually, we're in the middle of the end game. It's just a matter of time. The question is not if it will break down, it's the question when. And that's what you ask me. But this is really hard to answer because in 2011, when the euro had his first crisis and Greece was so close for bankruptcy, and really on the brink of collapse, everybody, every serious economist in Germany said, okay, that's it. They can't save it. And I was one of them. I predicted that the euro will be gone in the next couple of years. And I was wrong. But why was I wrong? Because they changed the rules. The ECB, the European Central Bank, just broke all the laws they had. They printed more money than they were allowed to. They broke the Maastricht rules, the treaty rules from Maastricht, for example. So it's the same like if you play soccer, and if you decide during the game, okay, we change the rules, we can use the hands, but not you. Of course, you can win the game, and you save the deadly patient actually, but the euro is dead. It's just a matter of time. But of course, they will put all the money, they will print even more money, they will do everything in their desperation to save the system, because they know they will be fucked. There will be like the people will hunt them down actually when the whole system collapses. So I think from my feeling, I like you, Tim, I would love to have it tomorrow actually done, and then we can go on, because we can't wait anymore, because we know this is all a scam and fake. But I think it will happen in the next, like in this decade, or some people say 2032, but I think the next years will be definitely the time when this whole system collapses. But remember, They will try everything. They will create a war to save the system, of course.
How does creating a war save the system?
It always does, actually, unfortunately, because if you have an enemy outside the system, then you grow together and you say, okay, we have to fight Putin, or we have to fight the aliens, or we have to fight whatever. It saves the system, because if there's too much debt in the system, you have four ways to solve the system or to solve the debt problem. The first one is, of course, growth, economic growth. It won't happen, because we see deglobalization. We live now in a multipolar world. We see the hegemon, the US, is faltering. Joe Biden is the perfect example that the US is actually not on the peak of his performance anymore. The second possibility, or the second thing, is you can inflation. You can inflate the whole system. That's what they try. But the thing is, we all get poorer, and people get not really easy. There can be social unrest and so on. The third way is a monetary reset, so like a hyperinflation and a new currency, a currency reset. This is very hurtful for the people, and it also can lead to social unrest and revolutions. And the last possibility is starting a war, because then you can say, oh, yes, the euro is gone, the dollar is gone, but hey, it's not our fault, it was Putin. Hey, you know, we had to fight them, and many people die. So this is also good for the retirement system, so we don't have to pay them anymore. So that's why you hear a lot of war rhetoric in Germany, but also in the UK. I think they're going for a war.
The last monetary reset was the Second World War. Am I right about that?
Yes, 1944.
Yeah.
Actually, it was the Bretton Woods system they implemented in 1944. But there was another one in 1971 when Richard Nixon closed the gold window.
Which was also connected with the war, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Very
expensive.
Well, exactly. They were trying to get them the gold back.
Yeah.
Something I thought of when I'm hearing about all this collapse of the monetary system and by default society. Do you personally, are you making any preparations outside of your financial life?
Of course, yes.
Can you tell me what they are?
Yeah. As a financial consultant, for example, I build strategies for my clients. And there's also always an exit strategy. So where do you want to live? Get out of the cities, for example. So I moved out of the city. I moved on the countryside. I'm have my own garden. I have solar panels. I have enough food in my cellar. But I also have an exit strategy outside of Germany, for example, if something happens. But then you need also the possibility to leave the country. So, for example, I've got enough petrol in my cellar for driving 2,000 kilometers. But I also have connections that I can take a plane or have other possibilities to leave the country. So everybody should think about it, because perhaps it hasn't to be, for example, the economic crash or something. It's enough if there's a terrorist attack and, for example, the power grid went down, or if there is like a social unrest or something happens, you know. And then you are happy if you have for 3 or 6 months enough food and water at home, or
pharmaceutical.
Sorry?
Pharmaceutical drugs.
Yeah, exactly. And so the thing is, you should be definitely autark, is it called autark?
What's that?
Autark, what's the main? Self-sufficient, yeah? So you're not independent, you should be independent.
Self-sovereign.
From every. Sorry?
Self-sovereign.
Self-sovereign, also, that's also a good book, yeah.
Yeah, sovereign individual.
Exactly.
Yes.
Self-sovereign, yeah, exactly, and you should have enough food and trading goods and water and everything at home, so you're not dependent on the government or on neighbors or something like that. And of course I would go, for example, on the borders of Europe, for example. You can go to Portugal or to Greece or somewhere else. I like that the UK actually exited the European Union, but I like the Yorkshire Dales. I thought about buying a house there, but the UK is also really fucked, for especially the cities are horrible. And if something went down the drain, I think it will be just like a civil clash and a civil unrest in the cities of the United Kingdom. But anyhow, yes, I've got preparations and I have plan B, C and D. And everybody who thinks something will happen in the next couple of years should definitely at least move out of cities or suburban areas to the countryside, create new networks and talk to people and have enough food for 3 to 6 months. And that's what I write in all my books. And of course, be independent from banks. Yeah, be your own bank with gold or Bitcoin or different assets.
It's interesting because we've done a similar thing. We live on a farm now.
Where?
In the UK. It's a remote place. But something I think of a lot now, having now arrived in that situation, is that, of course, being in a city is a bad idea. But the first thing that's going to happen over the weeks, if a collapse happens of sorts, the city will come to you.
Yes.
At that point. Yeah. And that may ruin your garden overnight. Mm. What do you think the solution to that is?
So at first, you have to live far away from the city.
Yeah, I do. No, yeah, we live a long way away.
It's like But the funny thing is, because after the Second World War, people told me that, of course, all the people from the city went to the countryside and they ate everything on the field and they robbed even everything from the cellar or from the farmers and so on. But some farmers also traded their food against, for example, carpets or jewelries or gold or so. So I know. I talked to one farmer who got filthy rich after the Second World War, selling all his food and sausages to the people from the city. It depends how the people will create. You know, people want to live in peace, actually, in harmony. They don't want to fight each other all the time. So perhaps there are some assholes, but 99% are good and they want to have a good life. And this is why a war is perhaps a catharsis, a crisis is important, so that people realize what is important in life. So important is that you live together with other human beings in peace and harmony. And nobody wants to be fighting all the time, looking over his neck and his shoulder and be afraid that somebody will kill you. This is a horrible life, actually. So I think if a citizen, if people from the city would come, for example, if you have enough food, just share it. Just share it. I was in Bolivia in 2003, and I was in the Andes, and there were really poor people. They slept on the naked floor, actually, and they gave me everything. They had nothing, but they gave me everything they had. And this showed me this is such a great gesture. Just give the people, share it. And if you share something, good will come back to you. This is like the karma. Yeah, you do something good and something good will happen to you. So I think positive, you know, I have a positive mental attitude and I think this crisis will just bring the people together. And if you act with a pure heart, you will be protected. So don't worry about it. So if somebody comes to your house and asks for food, give him some food. And if he is a weirdo or a bad person, okay, you will handle it. You will be protected.
According to what you believe and predict, if some kind of a catastrophe of the financial system occurred, is there any way that a transition to a Bitcoin standard, for example, could happen without a catastrophe? Because it kind of seems like it's kind of happening a little bit now, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I wish it happens like peacefully, the transformation to a Bitcoin standard. And we see the first signs, the light signs in the US, for example, that Trump embraces Bitcoin and that the Bitcoin spot ETF was implemented in the US. So I'm positive. Perhaps the US realized that Bitcoin is superior to all fiat monetary systems. And if we want to be the number one, the hegemon in the future, and if we want to be the government who implemented the world reserve currency, because the US dollar is definitely faltering, then perhaps we have to embrace Bitcoin and put it also in our balance sheets. And perhaps they realized it, and that they make little steps, but it's positive, of course. And I think right now it could be that the US is the only country in human history who will be two times afterwards the country who established the world reserve currency. At first with the USD, and perhaps now with the USD and Bitcoin.
It's interesting. You're the second person in 2 days who's told me that. Nico Gilch.
He told it from me.
All right. No, but we talked about it yesterday because I was more skeptical than that. Mm. I saw the possibility that the ETFs, for example, right? So Ethereum ETFs, right? Seems a bit strange.
Very strange.
Right. Okay. But if you were thinking of a way to attack Bitcoin, it might be that you say, wow, Bitcoin's amazing. You build it up. You get big players to invest in it, which is already happening. So large financial institutions. Then you bring the Ethereum one up, which is far more unstable, let's say, and associated with 1,000 or 2,000, 4,000, 5,000 other strange coins, scams. Right? Scams, yeah. And so now they're all in one basket. And now you have something like FTX happening, but you have BlackRock's trillions in there. The whole thing collapses, and then you can stand and say, look, there you go, this is a bad idea. Let's either regulate it to fuck so that no one can do anything with it, or we have to, it just turns everyone off it.
Yeah.
And it is a threat. I mean, Bitcoin is a threat. There's no question about it. You can't not be. Could that be something?
Yeah, they could say, you see, uncontrolled decentralized currencies are not a good idea. That's why we have the CBDC, the central bank digital currency, digital dollar. And this is much better because this is controlled, guys. So trust us, not the fucking Bitcoin thing. Of course, they try to fight it. They try to destroy it. And I think the real danger for Bitcoin is actually a gold standard again. Because if they establish and implement a gold standard, Bitcoin is done for the next couple of decades. It won't be gone totally, but I think the majority of the people trust gold more than Bitcoin. But yeah, you're right, actually. It could happen that they try to destroy it and that perhaps BlackRock takes the hit for it. But in the long run, they will win again.
But I mean, it was strange. BlackRock's change in opinion on Bitcoin was
so fast.
And so bizarre, from money laundering to a flight to safety very quickly.
I know, but I think positive. Perhaps somebody at a company explained to Larry Fink what Bitcoin is, and he got it. And that's I think you always have to give the people actually the opportunity to change their mind, you know. And you can change your mind. Look at yourself. Look at I saw it in my life that I changed my mind a couple of times. When I was young, I was a left socialist punk rocker, and now I know socialism is actually a plague. It's death. It's stupid, you know. And so everybody is allowed to change their mind. So this is great. That's why we have a round head.
What's your opinion on CBDCs then, or the viability of CBDCs? A lot of people say they're not even possible. A lot of people say it's not going to happen. What do you think?
It will happen, and I've also researched for my new book, and I wrote a whole chapter about it. I call this chapter The Digital Dictatorship. It's all about control and surveillance. And if you listen to Christine Lagarde from the ECB, for example, what are the pros for a CBDC, for digital euro? There is none. Because, for example, 96% of all transactions are already digital. We already have a digital currency. We already have a digital pound or euro or dollar. And there is no actually need for it. But the only thing is, they want to know who is buying, purchasing what, and who receives money. They want to have the total control in real time. Because right now, at the end of the day, the ECB just gets from all the banks the balance sheets and sees, okay, this bank received this and this amount of money and paid this and this, but they don't know which individual paid how much money for what. And if you have a CBDC and you have the wallet at the ECB, then it can track you down everything. And then they can, for example, create the Green Deal or the Green Dictatorship and say, okay, you had too much meat this month, that's too much, or you have a carbon wallet, for example, so CO2, and you also only allowed to fly once a year to Prague, for example. And if not, you have to pay for it. And it's all about taxes and paying more and be privileged. So perhaps the rich guys have the airports for them alone at the end. But I think this will happen. And what I hear, and I've got contact to the German Bundesbank, they work like with full power on the digital euro, and they know they need it, because then they have longer control over the fiat scam, because they know it's ending. And if you have a digital currency, then you can extend of the lifeline of the scam, and that's what they want. That's it.
What happens to normal banks when a CBDC
they disappear?
Happens? Do they?
Yes.
But would they let that happen? I mean, they're going to be really pissed off. I mean, banks are powerful too. I know central banks are really powerful, but so are banks.
The big ones will survive. But the ECB had always one goal: to get rid of the fucking banks. They hate the banks. And they were really successful, actually. We lost like 50% of the banks in Germany already, because the ECB always said, Europe is overbanked. Europe is overbanked. And there are just a couple of players left who will survive, and the rest will be gone. They don't like the little local banks, for example. Did you already have Richard Werner on the podcast? No. You should talk to him. He's brilliant. He's a good friend of mine. And he was on my event, and he was on my podcast as well. And he actually is the inventor of QE. He worked for the Bank of Japan. He's a German. He used to live and study and was a professor in the UK. And I can give you the contact. But he says the same. He says central banks or the ECB wants to destroy all the small banks, so they have only like the bunch of big banks around them, and they have the control of everything. And this is the goal, actually. They're pretty successful in the last couple of days. And the CBDC is just the last pin to achieve the goal.
What does the inventor of QE think about Bitcoin then?
Yeah, he likes it, but we have a lot of discussions about it. He likes Bitcoin, but he thinks we need more local banks. So he wants to diversify. He's a boomer, so he's not getting it. He's a very smart guy. I think he's one of the smartest guys I've ever met. And I love to talk to him. But yeah, he likes Bitcoin, but he is skeptical.
On what grounds, though?
I can't remember his arguments, but I don't know. You have to talk to him.
If you don't understand the technology, it can help to understand that, because I think a lot of people wonder if something might break. They're used to software that goes wrong, for example, or has glitches.
Tim, to be honest, it's still an experiment. You know, it's still something can happen. We don't know. Perhaps I don't know what can happen, but it's a Lindy effect. As older as it gets, as better it gets, and the more robust it is. And I think Bitcoin is like here to stay and proved itself. And I'm positive, actually.
What do you think the ECB says about Bitcoin when they're all talking about it, if they even talk about it? What do you think Christine Lagarde thinks about Bitcoin? Do you think she thinks it's a threat? Do you think she?
Okay. First of all, she has no knowledge about economy, so I don't think she thinks about monetary systems or Bitcoin. She said something negative about Bitcoin a couple of years ago in an interview. I know people from the ECB who got Bitcoin, who understand it, who even own it as a private person. But you will never hear from the ECB that Bitcoin is a good thing or it's important for the competition of currencies. I think they will always fight Bitcoin because they know it's a danger to the fiat scam, because it's a sound monetary system.
But you said you think people in the ECB own Bitcoin personally.
No, I know one person from the ECB who owns Bitcoin private.
I mean, that's a good sign. I mean, yes, I think this is one of the ways that Bitcoin wins, is that the game theory of Bitcoin, in as much as everyone ends up owning it, or even if a quarter of people end up owning it, some of them will be working in politics, in banks, in this, and they'll be whispering in the ears of people that make decisions because they're thinking about preserving their own wealth.
I can tell you one funny story, actually. A good friend of mine, he used for the Deutsche Bundesbank, and I can tell it because he's not working there anymore. And we had an interview before COVID, like 5 years ago in Berlin at a conference. I had an interview with him, and he actually made the case for Bitcoin, because I asked him what's the perfect monetary system, and he explained actually Bitcoin. And but to publish the interview, he had to get back to his superior, and I had to show them the video, and they called me, like, I don't know, I sent them the video, and 1 hour later they called me and said, okay, you're not allowed to publish this interview and you have to erase it.
Really?
I never erased it, of course. I still have it. But they were alarmed, because they knew I've got a big YouTube channel, and if a couple of 100,000 people will see this interview with a high profile manager from the German Bundesbank, people will perhaps lose the trust in the monetary system. I still have it in the deposit box at a bank. And perhaps one day, yeah, I will publish it. But it was amazing. And he was so happy about the interview, but his superior, I think he got real trouble and stress with his superior after this interview.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's a great story. And one day I will publish it and I will call you, Tim.
Well, it'll become a part of history, possibly.
Yes, yes, it is.
Okay, we're almost at an hour. I know you've got to get onto a talk, but let's round it up with some more concrete advice, because I think you have a particular view of the current situation we're in, and I think a lot of people are actually interested in preparation for worst case scenarios on the whole, and I think you put the worst case scenario case across very well. So give me the best preparatory procedures that you can take from across the board, from, you know.
My motto is, I think it's Winston Churchill who said, prepare for the worst, hope for the best. Or it was Sir Isaac something, Benjamin Israel or something, somebody else.
It's anyhow, a good quote, though.
Yeah. I think it's the perfect motto, prepare for the worst and hope for the best. So at first, you should get rid of all paper money. So if you have your money in a life insurance, if you have your money on the bank account, I would definitely put all the money in limited goods, for example, in gold, diamonds, in a forest, in land, because we live in an inflationary time and everything gets devalued. If you've got money on the bank account, it gets devalued. Your purchasing power is just going away, and then we will see taxes, and perhaps we also see perhaps that the bank or the government says, okay, we seize your money for, I don't know, for the war in Ukraine or because of the climate change or whatever the stupid idea they will create to get to your money. So that's why I would be would recommend everybody to at first understand the monetary system. And I think it was Henry Ford who said, if the majority would understand the monetary system, there would be a revolution the next day. And this is right, actually. If you understand the monetary system, how it works, that banks can create money out of thin air, and it is a gigantic mess and scam, actually, then you think totally different about the world. And this is going to end. This world we lived in for the last 75 years is going to end. This is totally normal. This is a new cycle, which is appearing every 80 to 100 years. So get rid of your paper money, get rid of insurances, of bank accounts, and transfer your money to limited goods, limited by nature or limited by math, like Bitcoin, for example. So I wrote 7 books about this. How do you prepare for the economic collapse and for the deglobalization, for a multipolar world, which we are right now in? So I would recommend, if you have a fable for gold, buy gold coins, buy silver. I'm a big fan of commodities. I'm a big fan of stocks, of course, like uranium, gold, copper, nickel, because I think in the future, all these commodities, which are also limited by nature, will go parabolic. Because if there is a deglobalization going on, and it is going on, we have a new cold war, yeah, then like copper or oil, gas, all the stuff the leftists hate will go parabolic, and we will need like fossil energy the next 150 years. I think we will definitely drive combustion cars in the next 50 years. So all this electric and transformation is not going to happen as fast as the green parties wish to. So I would definitely invest in diamonds. You can take a diamond to the airport, get into the plane and fly to South America, for example. I would invest in Bitcoin, and I would try to be self-sufficient and sovereign. With food, with water. Water and food is more important than Bitcoin, gold or diamonds. Yeah, because if you don't drink after one day, you will fucking die. Yeah, so you need water. This is more important. And of course, try to create new networks, talk to your neighbors, educate them, be a multiplier, and try to have a community where you can trust each other. This is the most important thing for the future. And I think food and water is the most important. And then afterwards, there is perhaps the monetary things like the prosperity things like gold, diamonds, a garden, and Bitcoin and stocks and so on. And if you want to know more, there's my YouTube channel, or you can follow me on Twitter, or X, it's called now.
Mark, thanks very much. I've got a lot to think about now. Fortunately, I have thought along these lines for a number of years, and I do find myself in a situation where we're not as far down that route as I could be. We've only just moved somewhere. We're getting a garden going. But I fully understand what you mean. And this is the one that often gets overlooked in about creating a good network.
Yeah, it's more important.
It is, because, for example, where I live now, that we have neighbors with cattle.
Yeah,
who perfect. Are selling locally now. They've started. Then they have been forced to sell locally because
the I've got hens now.
Yeah, we've got chickens.
I've got six hens, and I've got every day a fresh, five or six fresh eggs, you know. Yeah. And we have a garden, we have potatoes, we have a big, big, big cellar, and we've got so much food in there. So I always tell my wife, we could actually supply all the neighbors. And she says, that's good for the crisis. They will love you, you know. And this is great. So if somebody needs help, help them. So, and right now, if you have like 1 or 2,000 quid, invested in food at Lidl, Aldi or Tesco or wherever, it's so much food for the next couple of months. You can buy rice, noodles. They don't rot, actually. You can keep the noodles for 5 or 10 years. Nothing will happen to them, you know. So you can stock up your supplies and help the neighbors and everybody. So I think we are
crossroads.
We are on a crossroad.
I prefer inflection point.
Inflection point. We are on an inflection point. It's very good, actually, yeah. Yes. And we all feel that we are at a turning point of history. And I think it's so much important to be capable of, for example, grow your own veggies and perhaps bake your own bread and talk to the people and be handy. Be a handyman, you know, repair your bicycle. Nobody knows how to do it anymore. And there will be a time where we read books again and help each other. And if you have different talents, for example, I think it will be very, very good for the future. And everybody should get just prepared for it, because right now we're so dependent on each other like never before. And this is not healthy for human history or for the human race. Because I don't know how to cook, but now I know it, you know? Who knows how to, I don't know, exchange, for example, a tire at a bicycle, or grow your own potatoes? We lost the touch to the most essential things. And that's what we have to change. And I think there will be a reason soon that we will be forced to do it.
Well, thanks, Mark. Good luck.
You too, all
Thank
of
you.
Us, of course, yeah, for all of us.
As you walk away, I'll be like, maybe I'll see you one time on the other side, who knows.
We will. But the last thing I have to mention, guys, if you, on the brink of death, actually, if you look, one day we all will die, and then you just have to make up your mind and say, okay, what did I do to make the world a better place? And you can't take anything with you, not your stacks of Bitcoin, not your gold, not your house, not your hands, not your wife, nothing. So this is the most important question. What is the meaning of life and how can I create a better world? And I think that's what we all have to answer for ourselves.
Amen to that. Thank you, Mark. It's been great talking to you, mate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim, for the invitation.